भाष्यचारेषु चाहे
ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय So thank you all so much for being here. Many regulars and maybe a few guests. Of course, I also want to offer my gratitude for Vijaya Prabhu to come and see us for a few days. Very nice to have him here. Welcome. And of course, everybody else who is here today. We're going to read from the Bhagavad Gita 6:35. And we're going to be talking about controlling the mind through hearing. Today. Now, 6:35 is a verse where Lord Krishna begins speaking after Arjuna has made several comments and asked questions. So, I'm going to go back a couple verses first to 33 to sort of set the context here. So, starting with 33, and this is after Krishna has described a very elaborate yoga process to Arjuna. Which, of course, involves all sorts of meditation and yoga, austerities, renunciation, and it appears very, very difficult. So Arjuna said, O Madhusudana, the system of yoga which you have summarized appears impractical and unendurable to me, for the mind is restless and unsteady. 34. The mind is restless, turbulent, obstinate, and very strong, O Krishna. And to submit it, I think, is more difficult than controlling the wind. It's a very vivid example. Nobody can control the wind. You know, they predict a hurricane, but nobody can do anything about it. You can't stop it. You know, it's like a force of nature. It's unstoppable. So Arjuna is saying, similarly, the mind is like that. How can one control it? So now we come to text 35, where Krishna says, I'll just read it through for time. Sri Bhagavan Uvacha Ashangshaya Mahabaho Mahadurnigraham Chalam Abhyasena Tukontaya Vairagyena Chikriyate. Lord Sri Krishna said, O mighty armed son of Kunti, it is undoubtedly very difficult to curb the restless mind, but it is possible by suitable practice and by detachment. So, purport by His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada. The difficulty of controlling the obstinate mind, as expressed by Arjuna, is accepted by the personality of Godhead. But at the same time, he suggests that by practice and detachment, it is possible. What is that practice? In the present age, no one can observe the strict rules and regulations of placing oneself in a sacred place, focusing the mind on the Supersoul, restraining the senses and mind, observing celibacy, remaining alone, etc. By the practice of Krishna consciousness, however, one engages in 9 types of devotional service to the Lord. The first and foremost of such devotional engagements is hearing about Krishna. This is a very powerful transcendental method for the purging the mind of all misgivings. The more one hears about Krishna, the more one becomes enlightened and detached from everything that draws the mind away from Krishna. By detaching the mind from activities not devoted to the Lord, one can very easily learn Vairagya. So these two things were suggested by Krishna. There must be practice and also Vairagya. Prabhupada continues, Vairagya means detachment from matter and engagement of the mind in spirit. Impersonal spiritual detachment is more difficult than attaching the mind to the activities of Krishna. This is practical, because by hearing about Krishna, one becomes automatically attached to the Supreme Spirit. This attachment is called parashanubhuti, spiritual satisfaction. It is just like the feeling of satisfaction a hungry man has for every morsel of food he eats. The more one eats while hungry, the more one feels satisfaction and strength. Similarly, by the discharge of devotional service, one feels transcendental satisfaction as the mind becomes detached from material objectives. It is something like curing a disease by expert treatment and appropriate diet. And some of you will recognize, of course, that's a reference to a famous verse in the second chapter of the 11th canto. Hearing of the transcendental activities of Lord Krishna is therefore expert treatment for the mad mind, and eating the foodstuff offered to Krishna is the appropriate diet for the suffering patient. This treatment is the process of Krishna consciousness. Om Gyanatim Randasya Gyananjana Salakaya Chakshuram Nitamena Tasma Shigare Namaha Vanchakopa Triyubhischa Kripa Sindhu Bhivacha Patitano Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha. So Arjuna recognized the problem that we all have in Kali Yuga in this material world. That's the problem with the mind. Specifically, the ability to be able to control the mind. As he says, the mind is more difficult to control. It's more restless than the wind. But Krishna gives a simple answer, but a very profound answer. He said, it is possible by constant practice and detachment. So we can understand, of course, there are many verses about the mind in this sixth chapter, the Bhagavad Gita, that one of our biggest problems in spiritual advancement is the mind, the control of the mind. This is a real impediment for the aspiring transcendentalist who wants to become self-realized. Now, the Bhagavad Gita tells us it's not just that the mind is all bad, the mind is the enemy, but rather, the mind is our best friend or our worst enemy. It is really a question of the application of the mind. Earlier in this chapter, in Bhagavad Gita chapter 6, verses 5 and 6, Krishna says, one must deliver himself with the help of his mind and not degrade himself. The mind is the friend of the conditioned soul and his enemy as well. For him who has conquered the mind, the mind is the best of friends, but for one who has failed to do so, his mind will remain the greatest enemy. So, we need to talk a little bit about why the mind is a problem and how one can make the mind his best friend. Because if one can make one's mind one's best friend, it's described that that one will not degrade himself, and he will, in fact, later Krishna will go on to say the great benefit of controlling the mind, how one will attain to spiritual knowledge and understanding. Why is the mind a problem? Our mind is with us all the time. It's working, right? It's active. We're very aware of our mind. So what does the mind do? It's interesting because Bhagavad Gita gives us an understanding. It gives us a realization of psychology. It's a spiritual psychology which describes how the gross and the subtle body work, and specifically how the mind, intelligence, and false ego, what we call the subtle body, how they interact and how the soul is affected. So, the mind is the focal point of the senses. All the sensory information from, of course it's described, there's the five primary sense-gathering senses, sense gathering. And then, of course, there's the object of the senses, there's working senses. But basically, all of this information that we receive from hearing, from seeing, touch, taste, smell, go to the mind, right? And the mind is the center. It's the focal point, and what does the mind do? It accepts or rejects the information that is supplied to it by the senses. In other words, I taste something, and my mind, my tongue itself is, it's just perceiving a sensation. But the evaluative component is in the mind. The mind is saying, I like this or I don't like this, right? And if the mind says, I like this, then what does the mind do? It goes and gets a second helping. It gets some more, right? So in other words, that's the mind is making evaluations, accepting and rejecting sensory information, and then acting upon that. Although the mind can't really act upon it itself. The mind actually needs the help of intelligence. Intelligence evaluates this information, and it'll help the mind plan how he can get more of that, whatever it might be, that rasgulla or sandesh or pizza or whatever it is, and make a plan accordingly. Intelligence is more the plan maker, So, it's described that the mind's activities are thinking, feeling, and willing. The mind accepts materially favorable things and rejects the unfavorable. Okay, so thoughts come in, we think about things, we feel things, and then will. There's volition. There's active behavior on our part coming from the mind, and of course the intelligence is then helping to execute that. So Prabhupada describes this process and the problem with the mind a little bit. He says, if through yoga the mind can be trained and the mind is our friend, but if the mind is left untrained, there is no possibility of leading a successful life. For one who has no idea of spiritual life, the mind is the enemy. If one thinks that he is simply the body, the mind will not be working for his benefit. It will simply be acting to serve the gross body and to further condition the living entity and entrap him in material nature. That does not sound like a friend, does it? One who wants to entrap me in material nature more and more. If, however, one understands our position as the spirit soul apart from the body, then the mind can be a liberating factor. So we have to understand the mind has a very definite place. The mind, of course, can be spiritualized. It can work in Krishna's service, but more often than not, the mind tends to be more troublesome. The mind alone cannot understand the absolute truth. The mind is a subtle material element. The absolute truth is transcendental, is spiritual energy. So a material element cannot perceive spiritual or transcendental reality. And therefore, it's very limited in how it can help us in spiritual life. I was thinking a little bit today how in the early years, maybe we still do, but I remember particularly in the early years, that's 40, 50, 60 years ago, I don't remember. Anyway, I've been around a long time. About 40 years ago, we used to talk a lot about the mind, and remember the mental plane, right? Are you on the mental plane? Some of you older devotees may remember that this is part of the sort of the terminology, the jargon that we used a lot about, because we were very aware of how the mind could be troublesome and get us in trouble. So we were cautious about the mind, and we used to discuss it a lot, whether we were listening to our mind or whether we were listening to the higher authority of the scriptures, a spiritual master, Krishna, Supersoul, etc. I think now we have a tendency, I don't know if things have really changed very much, but we probably always did. We all have a tendency to think of the mind as the self. And I've talked about this before, it's one of my themes, that we often see that my tastes, my interests, my desires, what I'm into right now, in other words, basically the workings of my mind, that this is myself, this is who I am, this is myself, this is really me. And you have to understand me, you have to get me, you have to know all of these things that I'm into and my interests and all that. But these are temporary manifestations of the subtle body, of the mind and the intelligence. They're not who we are. Who we are is the spirit soul. Is the pure spirit soul part and parcel of Krishna, has eternal relationship with God, and our relationship with God is one of devotional service. So if we were thinking we are something different than that, that's illusion. Now, granted, most of us probably are often thinking we are something different than pure servant of Krishna, because our conditioned nature is there, and for countless lifetimes we've been in this material world thinking these things, thinking that we are our bodily designations. When we're in a human body or a dog body or a tree body, we think that's who we are. And even if we're in a human body, which affords us the opportunity of higher intelligence, we tend to think we are these designations. I'm man, I'm woman, I'm Indian, I'm American, whatever it might be. But none of these things are who we are. So we need to cultivate higher knowledge, and that really is not going to come from the mind. First of all, the mind is very limited. The cultivation of the mental ability or even the cultivation of material intelligence cannot help us in spiritual life. In the Bhagavad Gita later, it talks about four kinds of people who do not come to Krishna consciousness. Right? One of those is mayaya prahiti jnana, right? One whose knowledge is stolen by illusion. So there are very intelligent people, very intelligent, certainly smarter than I am. But what are they lacking? The intelligence is stolen by illusion, which means they're not being directed, utilizing that large intelligence in the right place. When I was in college, many, many decades ago, I remember I was a philosophy major for one semester, then I was an anthropology major, then I was a history major, and then I was, anyway, the flickering mind was very active then, because none of these particular, subject matters seemed to really give me what I wanted. I mean, you know, I've tried all these things, but they weren't really very satisfying, of course, until somehow or another, by Krishna's arrangement, I received Prabhupada's Bhagavad Gita, and life started to make a little sense. But before that, you know, I was very enthusiastic at one point in my young life to study philosophy. And as a philosophy major, our university had these symposiums where you could go and you could hear the, these great, not really great thinkers, but a lot of them were graduate students or professors that were there. Anyway, their thoughts on what they were studying and researching in philosophy. So the first one I went to was a philosophy symposium about Kant's paradoxes. And Kant's paradox talked about incongruent counterparts and relativity and orientation in space. So that's kind of far out, sounds deep. And so what really came down to Immanuel Kant, his paradox was, if you had a hand in space with nothing else around, how would you know if it was a left hand or a right hand? That's pretty profound. That was the last symposium I went to, and I changed my major the next semester. And of course, on top of that, not that I was so pure myself, but I was a little disappointed that where most of the philosophy professors, if you ever wanted to find them, you didn't go to the office, you went down to the Shamrock Bar. That's where they all hung out and basically, I guess, enhanced their deep thoughts over, anyway. So, yeah, the mental and the intellectual platform, plane, way of approaching knowledge does not help us to understand the absolute truth. And it doesn't really solve any of our material and spiritual problems of life. The mind searching for what's going to give it satisfaction is not going to conquer over birth, death, disease, and old age. It's not going to help us with the adibodhic, adiatmic, adididic miseries of life. So, where do we turn? Well, there is the intelligence, and intelligence is different than the mind, as we said. The intelligence tends to formulate plans to fulfill the mind's desire, but also that's the material intelligence. But Prabhupada described real intelligence. Real intelligence is the power of discrimination, and specifically the ability to discriminate between matter and spirit. Prabhupada said that is real intelligence. To know what is the body, what is the soul, what is the difference between material energy and spiritual energy. And therefore, the more awakened intelligence or spiritual intelligence is able to guide us to our best interest, is able to help control the mind and guide us in the right way to take up spiritual life. There's an interesting analogy Srila Prabhupada makes. This is from a purport 4.29.7 of the Srimad Bhagavatam. Prabhupada says, according to training, the mind is the friend and the enemy of the living entity. If one gets a good manager, his estate is very nicely arranged. Now, many of you with your estates, you always want to have a good manager, right? Okay, I don't have an estate either. But if you had an estate, you'd want a very good manager. But if the manager is a thief, his estate is spoiled. Similarly, in his material conditional existence, the living entity gives power of attorney to the mind. As such, he is liable to be misdirected by his mind into enjoying sense objects. This struck me as a really nice analogy, this power of attorney. You all know what power of attorney is. Let's say I am very sick and I'm not able to execute my affairs very well, I'm an invalid or whatever. I may give power of attorney to a relative, somebody I trust. So I give power of attorney. Is that right? Am I saying this right? You lawyers can correct me here. Anyway, you give them the power to make decisions on your behalf, basically, right?
That's right.
So if I give power of attorney and that person says, I'm going to withdraw all the cash from Tamahar's bank account and I'm going to spend it here or whatever, he can do that because I've given the power of attorney. So Prabhupada says we are giving the power of attorney to the mind. And what happens? It's not a very good choice. It's kind of like if I give power of attorney to the thief who steals everything from my estate. I give power of attorney to the mind. Okay, whatever the mind dictates, I'm there, I'm with you. We can be led far, far astray into simply trying to enjoy this material world, thinking we are this body, we are these senses, we are this mind. And we go farther and farther away from spiritual life, farther and farther away from our real position as servant of Krishna, as friend of Krishna, and far away from the instructions of Krishna's representatives, the spiritual master. So, we don't want to give the power of the mind, the power of attorney to the mind. We want to give the power of attorney where? Well, to our spiritual intelligence, to our spiritual master, to the enlightened acharyas, those who actually know what is truth, and ultimately, of course, to Krishna. Krishna also acts as the super soul within the heart. So if I am giving my power of attorney to those great spiritual persons, then I'm going to be led in the right direction. So, need to control the mind so the mind does not take charge. First, Krishna says we do it through practice. And Srila Prabhupada points out in his purport that spiritual practice begins with hearing. Very important that we hear. What does hearing mean? Well, you know, so many sounds come into the ear, but this means hearing spiritual sound, spiritual vibration, the chanting of the holy name, the scriptures, the Bhagavad Gita, the words of the Guru. We want to hear the Vedic scriptures. We want to hear the Bhagavad Gita, but we want to hear also from the right source, from a pure devotee, one who understands Bhagavad Gita. And that is why we are always reading Srila Prabhupada's purports, Srila Prabhupada's commentary on the Bhagavad Gita to help us understand what is the real intent of Krishna in his words in the Bhagavad Gita. How many of you read a Bhagavad Gita before you read Srila Prabhupada's Bhagavad Gita? I did. Anybody else read Bhagavad Gita? Did you get a lot out of it? Did you understand it really deeply? And you really understood who Krishna was God and you should serve God? I sure didn't. I had no idea what the Bhagavad Gita meant until I read Srila Prabhupada's Bhagavad Gita. Now, maybe I might be a little slow. Maybe others got something, but I thought it was interesting. It was kind of, you know, far out, you know. But no, it wasn't until reading Srila Prabhupada's purports and commentaries on the Bhagavad Gita, I became convinced that this was real knowledge. I became convinced this was the person who could give me real knowledge, and this real knowledge of Krishna was true. So the effect of hearing spiritual sound vibration from the right source is that first we gain transcendental knowledge and knowledge of our spiritual nature, which means that we understand that we are not this body, we are not material, but we are spiritual beings. We understand our eternal relationship with Krishna. Self-realization doesn't just mean knowing the self. Here I am, I'm realized, I'm this. No, Prabhupada explains, self-realization means self in relationship. Absolute truth means relationship. This is the nature of everything. This is one of those sort of primal truths of the universe, that everything is based on relationship, because that original relationship is between God and the living entity, God and the soul. That's the real relationship. So true self-realization means knowing ourselves in relationship to Krishna. And then when this knowledge is given, the mind and intelligence become convinced. Because after all, if the mind isn't convinced, you're not going to do something. Someone can be so persuasive, they can be the best salesperson, whatever. And you think they're kind of, you know, sometimes they think they've convinced you, or I think I've convinced somebody, and you walk away and you go, no, I don't think so. Because the mind was not really convinced. How does the mind become convinced? The mind in spiritual life, the mind becomes convinced when it comes in contact with the absolute truth and with a person, the pure devotee of the Lord, such as Srila Prabhupada, who represents the absolute truth. And that touches our heart in a way that no other material knowledge can. It's a very different experience, and we've all have had that experience of being touched by the spiritual knowledge given by Srila Prabhupada and Krishna. So, when that happens, our attachment to the material lessens. We become less attached to the pushings of the senses and to the dictations of the mind. We become attracted to Krishna, to Krishna's devotees, to Krishna's service, to Krishna's prasadam, opens up a whole other world. And the mind becomes purified. Self-realization is not just a matter of knowledge, but it's a process of purification. The Srimad Bhagavatam 127 says, by rendering devotional service unto the personality of Godhead, Sri Krishna, one immediately acquires causeless knowledge and detachment from the world. Now, interestingly, here the Bhagavatam does not say, if I gain a lot of knowledge and I become very detached or renounced, then I will gain Krishna. It's the other way around. It says, by rendering devotional service to Krishna, then one acquires knowledge and detachment. So that's why we are always stressing the positive. Prabhupada always said, don't give up, add. Add Krishna consciousness to your life. Add chanting Hare Krishna to your life. Because when you do that, when you take up spiritual life and you get a taste of that relationship with Krishna, then automatically knowledge is revealed and one becomes more and more detached from material things. So this detachment or vairagya is needed. Krishna says, by practice and vairagya, detachment. But it must be properly understood. It can't be an artificial vairagya. I was thinking a story, many of you have heard this. It's probably one of the more famous Buddhist stories that we often hear. I'll just read it real quickly. Two traveling monks, one older and one young, reached a river where they met a young woman. Wary of the current, she asked if they could carry her across. The young monk hesitated, but the older one quickly picked her up onto his shoulders, transported her across the water, and put her down on the other bank. She thanked him, and they departed. As the monks continued on their way, the young one was brooding and preoccupied. Unable to hold his silence, he finally spoke out, "Brother, our spiritual training teaches us to avoid any contact with women, but you picked that one up on your shoulders and carried her." So, what did he say? He said, "I put her down on the bank of the river hours ago, and all of this time you have been carrying her in your mind." So the young monk was trying to follow the rules, but his mind was actually attached. But the older monk was not really detached. He saw the needful, this person needed help, gave him the help, and went on his way, his mind undisturbed. Where the younger one, not so experienced in the world, not so experienced in spiritual life, mind remained attached. So his renunciation was artificial in a sense, where the older monks had real renunciation. So the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, Nectar of Devotion, describes proper and improper vairagya. Rupa Goswami says that we avoid unnecessary renunciation. Why? Because it may harden the heart. Now, some renunciation is necessary. We have regular principles. You know, we need to give up the dictations of the mind and senses, as we were saying earlier. So that's there. But too much artificial renunciation, it's described by actually Jiva Goswami in his commentaries and by Rupa Goswami, that it hardens the heart. But there is real renunciation, and that's, of course, when Rupa Goswami describes Yukta Vairagya. Real renunciation is accepting those things favorable to devotional service. So we try to not reject everything, but we utilize everything in Krishna's service. Srila Prabhupada used to, you know, he explained this point many, many times in his early lectures, and you probably have heard some of these, remember them. One example I remember he gave several times, he talked about his dictaphone. You know, Srila Prabhupada was translating all of the scriptures, the Srimad Bhagavatam, etc. He would, in his dictaphone, dictate the purports, and then, of course, those were transcribed by his, you know, secretaries and servants, and later compiled into the books. So Prabhupada would say, just like this dictaphone. In other words, this is a modern electronic convenience. It's a material object. But we are using it to translate the Srimad Bhagavatam, therefore it is spiritual. So, dictaphone is spiritual. Everything that is used in Krishna service is spiritual. Ultimately, everything is spiritual. We don't want to become Mayavadis or anything, because there is distinction. It's not that everything is one, but ultimately everything is spiritual because everything is Krishna's energy. He has different energies. He has the material energy, he has spiritual energy, then he also mentions the seventh chapter of Bhagavad Gita, then he mentions the jiva soul. And he describes those energies, and he describes how he is in control of all of those. But the material energy is Krishna's energy, therefore it can be utilized in his service and becomes spiritual. So we don't reject anything in relation with Krishna. Therefore, we want to absorb our mind, how? In hearing about Krishna and Krishna's service. So there's great power in hearing about Krishna and from Krishna. We hear from Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita, his instructions to Arjuna, and we hear about Krishna in other scriptures like the Srimad Bhagavatam, which great devotees describe Krishna's pastimes and Krishna's instructions. So we need to hear from the Bhagavad Gita and the Srimad Bhagavatam. Bhagavatam 1.3.40 says, the Srimad Bhagavatam is the literary incarnation of God, and it's compiled by Srila Vyasadeva, the incarnation of God. It is meant for the ultimate good of all people, and is all successful, all blissful, and all perfect. So the Srimad Bhagavatam is described as the literary incarnation of God. So when we associate with these literatures, when we hear Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam, we are directly associating with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. A couple of verses later, Prabhupada says in the purport, In other words, if men in this age of Kali want to see the real light of life, they must take to these two books only, and their aim of life will be fulfilled. Bhagavad Gita is a preliminary study of the Bhagavatam, and Srimad Bhagavatam is the summum bonum of life, Sri Krishna personified. We must therefore accept Srimad Bhagavatam as the direct representation of Lord Krishna. So Srila Prabhupada emphasized reading his books, that everyone should hear the philosophy of Krishna, thus become purified, become convinced of spiritual life, and take up this practice. And Prabhupada also emphasized distributing these books. Not that we simply sit in my room, I read these books, I feel, oh, now I have this knowledge. But the compassionate nature of the devotees, such as Srila Prabhupada, was such that they want to give this knowledge to everyone. So Srila Prabhupada very much emphasized the writing and publication of his books and widely distributing these books throughout the world and all in many, many languages. So at last count, Vijay can probably help me here, are we up to 500 or 600 million Srila Prabhupada's books distributed worldwide? 530 million. I'm ad libbing here. Vijay's presence inspired me to start talking about book distribution. Thank you. 530 million books. That's a great impact. It's a great impact of all of these people hearing. You can say, well, maybe not everybody reads them. They've gotten a book. No, not everybody reads them. But how many stories do we know if that person that got the book didn't read them, but somebody else did? I've heard so many stories. A book sat on a bookshelf for 10 years. Somebody walks in the room, picks it up, says, what's this? 2 years later, they're in the Hare Krishna temple. They tell you my favorite one about the car thieves? Well, at least not for a month or two, right? You know, I have to be careful how much I repeat my stories. Anyway, there were two brothers. They were devotees in the Miami temple, but I think they joined in Detroit. They were car thieves. And they stole this car that had a Bhagavad Gita in the back seat. They read the book. They joined the temple, and they became devotees. So who knows how this transcendental literature can turn the lives of people around from being a common thief to becoming a Vaishnava, a devotee of God, practicing, you know, this very, very wonderful practice of serving the Lord. This is the remarkable ability in this process of hearing. And of course, after hearing, we have what? Shravanam, Kirtanam, Vishnu Smaranam. Then comes chanting. So we hear about spiritual life, we hear about the chanting of the holy name, we begin the process of chanting. And by chanting, we become purified. And that enhances our hearing, because it enables us to have realization. If one is chanting Hare Krishna, one's realization of these books will increase automatically. It's guaranteed. If one isn't chanting, one may struggle a little bit. But if one is chanting, the heart opens up, the heart becomes purified. The heart is in a ready, willing place to accept the spiritual knowledge, to experience this knowledge coming from Krishna and Srila Prabhupada. So, we're getting close to, we're almost out of time. I'll end with the next verse of Bhagavad Gita after 635, which we read, which is, for one whose mind is unbridled, self-realization is difficult work. Yes. But he whose mind is controlled and who strives by appropriate means is assured of success. So the appropriate means were practice and detachment, taking up this process of hearing and chanting, and then one is assured of success. Thank you very much. There's probably a couple minutes if anyone has a comment or question. Yes, Prabhu. Is there a microphone? It's hard to hear.
Hello? So, at the moment of death, whatever we're thinking of or whatever desire we have, our mind transports us to the next body or our next birth.
Yes.
But if we're thinking of Krishna, is it the mind that transports us all the way to the Loka Vrindavan? Like, is there a mind in the spiritual world? Like, are we still thinking in the spiritual world?
Okay.
Or is the mind just a material realm?
That's interesting because, of course, it says in the, what is it, chapter 8, verse 5, about whatever state of being one, oh, that's sovereign of the Loka. Anyway, whatever state of being one attains in this lifetime, at that time he will attain appropriate body after death. So that's there. It's a matter of consciousness. Now, for one who is liberated, who's able to go back to Godhead, that consciousness is completely purified, which means that the mind, intelligence, and ego, which are there, are also completely purified. So, yeah, it's not like people in the spiritual world don't think, you know, which is what we often attribute to the mind. Of course, everything is there, but everything is purified. Everything we see in this material world is considered to be a reflection of the spiritual world. So, devotees, spirit souls in the spiritual world certainly have thoughts, they have feeling, they have willing, but it's all centered on Krishna, it's all purified.
So the whole point of liberation is not to not have a mind, but
right.
To purify the mind.
To purify the mind, yes.
Thank you, Prabhu.
It's a good question, thank you. Appreciate that. Yeah, it's a good one to think about because we so often, that's why they say it's the best friend, the worst enemy, or the worst best friend. The purified mind can be the best friend. It helps to bring us back to Krishna. Yeah. Yamaraj.
Thank you for your class. Yeah. My question, two questions. Would you say faith is very important in advancing in Krishna consciousness?
Yes. Second question.
And the second question is, in your own personal experience as been a devotee for quite a while, what has mostly increased your faith in the process?
Oh, great question. Backing up one step, I would say that's one thing that many of us who've been devotees for many years can say that are probably, I don't know that I've advanced in so very many ways, still feel very neophyte, but I can say that probably myself and others who have been doing this 40, 50 years, our faith does increase. And, you know, that's one thing I can say, that probably we gain some advancement as we go along the process of Krishna consciousness, that over the years, our faith does increase. You know, you're asking what helps to make our faith increase? Well, the obvious answer is, of course, hearing and chanting, the process of devotional service, association with devotees, because, you know, faith is the beginning of the stages shraddha, of devotional service. But every stage that we go through also increases our faith. So as our association with devotees, sadhusanga, our hearing and chanting, the bhajana kriya, our, all of the, as we go through each of these stages, that original faith increases more and more. And I would just say on a more sort of simple, I guess not so much a scriptural answer, but a personal answer, I think faith just increases from experience, of just seeing how Krishna works, feeling Krishna works, seeing so many times how Krishna's there and Krishna's working, Srila Prabhupada is there. You know, and as we go along in Krishna consciousness, we have those types of realizations. We go from jnana, which is more intellectual knowledge, to vijnana, which is realized knowledge. And that realized knowledge based upon experience, the Prabhupada also sometimes describes as experienced knowledge as well, that I think creates faith, strengthens faith. Yeah. Okay. Yes. Did you get the, give this gentleman the, oh, here's the microphone. And maybe after, not right now. We have to end the class right now. Okay, just now. Anyone on the lady side or anyone else? Whoa, in the back. Okay, Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna, Prabhu. It was a nice class. I definitely wanted to ask you about why do we use the term the mind as an enemy? It's a very simplistic question. Why can it be more like, well, it's one that's in the kind of caught in illusion? Why do we decipher it as an enemy and distinct that?
Yeah.
Why do we have that such distinction?
Yeah. Well, it is Krishna's. They're Krishna's words. Krishna says two or three times in the. And he actually says at least three times in the sixth chapter. He calls the mind the enemy. And Prabhupada described that why we say it's the enemy, because it takes us away from Krishna. In other words, if the mind is pulling us away from Krishna, then it's not really our friend. Enemy may be a little strong. We don't have to always use that word. You could just say the mind can cause disturbances, or, you know, the mind tends to propel us towards illusion, like that. You know, it's not necessary to use the word enemy, but Krishna uses it, so I repeated it. Yeah. All right. That's a good point.
Okay.
We could use that. Yes. Wait for the microphone. Okay, I think everybody probably wants to get Prashadam, maybe one more.
On that note, I think right alongside is the mind is your best friend if it's controlled. So it can be your best friend too. I just want to point that out. It doesn't have to be your enemy unless it's, you know, totally out of control.
Yeah, that's the positive side, that the mind can be the best friend, and that's what we want it to be, not to be the enemy. Yeah, we don't want to make friends and enemies. We just want to make friends of the mind. Okay, I think we should end. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Krishna.
I'll ask you if you want to take
the whole conversation.
Thank you.
Hare Krishna. There's one problem. I cannot follow with the hand. But you can sing afterwards. Take mine. Mine is in the Pujari. Mine. Take it. Hare Krishna.
Like
doubt. Please forward, please.
Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, Hare Krishna. Krishna, Krishna, Krishna.